letters or polished boots, anything to get back in character. Alistair sat back down beside Hilda. Now the rumbling of bombs was further off. It boomed through the cellar and set up a discordant vibration in the untuned strings of an old piano. "Which of you requested this?" said Alistair. "Worst tune I ever heard." Mary frowned.
"Philistine, you soldiers want everything in a major key."
"Quite right, too. And in 4/4 time, so we can march to it."
Tom said, "I wish you two would stop pretending this is funny."
Alistair nodded his apology. "I know this isn't much fun." Tom pursed his lips.
"No, I'm sorry. I can't... It's just that..."
"It's all right," said Alistair. "I was exactly the same my first time. Here, I know what will cheer us up.
Remember that jam you made?"
He was rummaging for it in his duffel bag when the array of electric bulbs flickered and went out. The players murmured in alarm. Beside Alistair, Hilda was tight as a board, the hysteria hardening beneath her skin. He was sobering up with every bang, and with each nervous twitch of Hilda's body, he felt less inclined to soothe and more disposed to snap at her. He sparked his lighter so at least they could all see.
"Does anyone have a piece of string I could hang this with?"
"I have some sewing cotton," said Mary.
"Fine."
"Does it matter what colour? I have pink, red, or white?"
Alistair understood that she was being less than serious. His irritation vanished. With her cotton, he fixed the lighter to a bulb flex. His fingers did the work with their old skill. The shifting flame tossed their shadows back and forth, as if they were not fixtures in society, but only tricks of the light.
"It was good of you to invite us down here," said Mary.
Zachary's father smiled.
"It was nice of you to come and see our show."
"You must come and see ours. We'll have a nativity near Christmas."
"You have enough children for all the parts?"
"I think so. One really only needs a holy couple, an angel, and a narrator. Some wise men would be nice, but then isn't that just like life?"
Alistair winked at Tom.
"You're not going to let that stand."
But Tom only gripped the bench and flinched at the bangs. In the guttering light, Alistair saw the slow look Mary gave him.
"You're good with this," said Hilda,
her head back on Alistair's shoulder.
"Well, I grew up in a mine, you see."
She snuggled closer.
"I don't suppose you'd mind putting your arm around me?"
Soon the lighter flame burnt out, and all of them waited in the dark. More bombs fell, and with each one, Hilda pressed closer. Once or twice, at a particularly loud explosion, she gave a shriek. When she was halfway into his lap, Alistair eased her off and stood up.
"Would you all excuse me? I ought to contact my regiment."
"Will you come back?" said Hilda.
"Don't worry," said Alistair.
"Oh, I wish you wouldn't go."
Her voice was such a porridge of fright that it made him glad to leave. Here and there, the basement was lit by the glow of cigarettes, and a little further along, someone had set up a candle. Alistair made his way to the staircase and up to the theatre. Once upstairs, the sound of the anti-aircraft guns was loud and close. The backstage area was lit up by flashes entering through an open stage door. Alistair made for that, tripping over props and drapes, and then he was outside in the narrow alley beside the theatre. It was half dark, and the hot air was sharp with smoke. Alistair scanned the sky, listening to the bombers and the anti-aircraft guns. Searchlights cut the crimson base of what might have been smoke or might have been cloud. From the noise and the angle of the beams, the main body of the attack was a fair way off, a mile, maybe two. Underground, with that awful resonance, it had seemed closer. He went back into the theatre and nosed round by the light of the flashes until he found wine on one of the tables. He leaned back into the scoop of the Baby Grand, took a long drink, and stared up at the theatre. The gun flashes glinted on the gold columns and the high proscenium arch.
"I'm to tell you to come back down immediately."
He turned. Mary had come from the basement and now stood watching him. The occulting light lit her up, her cigarette smoke flashing silver.
"You probably ought to go back down yourself," he said.
She said nothing, only stood with her arms crossed.
"Did the others send you to fetch me?"
"Hilda is a wonderful girl. We've been friends since we were six. She is mischievous and loyal and very funny until a man walks into the room, when upon her IQ immediately halves. But it is only shyness, you see. I'm sure the phenomenon would vanish as you got to know her."
He filled his pipe in the stuttering light.
"Would you like some wine? I'm afraid I was drinking from the bottle."
"Oh, you see, this is why I prefer civilians."
"Do you have a lighter?" She came to the other side of the baby grand and slid him the lighter while he slid her the bottle. She took a short drink. Outside, the anti-aircraft guns let off a salvo, making them both flinch.
"You really should go back down," he said.
"I shall be glad to. Right behind you."
"Look, Hilda is lovely. It's me. I'm really not myself at the moment."
"Oh, for pity's sake, who is? You're an army officer. I'm a schoolteacher. The whole world is in fancy dress."
"I just need a bit of time."
"Fine," said Mary. "I shall wait here with you."
"I meant... oh, never mind."
"I know what you meant," said Mary. "But Hilda is a hoot. She likes parties and big bands and subterfuge. You shan't tell me you don't like such things. She plays tricks on me and runs rings around my mother, and she once set fire to a baronet's motor car because he lent it to Oswald Mosley."
"Forget romance. We ought to parachute her behind enemy lines."
Mary sighed.
"I wish you would kiss her first."
Alistair drank some wine. The flashes through the open stage door left green after-images of the bottle glass. He said, "Tom is a good man, you know."
"Oh, I know. I hope you didn't read too much into..."
"It's just that the two of you seemed a little..."
"Well, it's the war, isn't it? It's one thing for you, being out there in the action. Cooped up in town, we get snippy."
"Tom really believes in teaching, that's the thing. I suppose he can't bear to have it all interrupted."
"I liked it about him straight away. Men usually bleat about one's looks, but Tom had to know exactly what I thought about the new Education Act."
Alistair smiled.
"And he's a useful cook, of course. He can take thoroughly demoralised ingredients and give them back their will to live."
"And he has taken great risks for me. It does his career no good to let me have my school."
"But that's just like Tom, isn't it? Thoroughly unselfish."
"Yes, thoroughly."
"I rather resent having to surrender him to you."
"Blame Hitler," said Mary.
"Oh, I do. I will seduce his flatmate the moment we capture Berlin."
"I hope you and Hitler's flatmate will be jolly happy together."
"Well, I'm glad that you and Tom are."
"Oh, we are."
"Well, that's fine," said Alistair.
"And look, Hilda is terrific. You shouldn't judge her just because she..."
"Oh, of course not. Nobody's brave the first time in an air raid." Mary took a longer drink of the wine.
"It's much better up here, isn't it? The bombs aren't nearly so close as one imagines when one is down below."
"I expect they're attacking the docks."
Mary slid the bottle back to him.
"Should we go and look? I mean, there mightn't be another air raid. I'd hate to think I missed the one chance."
Alistair said nothing.
"What?"
said Mary.
"You make it sound like the Jubilee fireworks."
"Are you scared?"
"Yes, and so should you be."
"I'm a grown-up."
"Still, I wouldn't want to get you hurt."
"Let's not get hurt, then. Let's just go a little way."
He hesitated.
"All right."
"As close as we can, just to see what it looks like."
Outside, the sky was lurid. The sound of the bombs seemed distant, and it was hard to make out the direction while the echoes rolled up the white marble canyon of the Strand. Light came in all colours and from all directions. Smoke, or cloud, hung at a few thousand feet, looming blue-white when searchlights cut in on it from below, flashing yellow when exploding anti-aircraft shells lit it from above. It was 7:30 in the evening, and the sun seemed to be setting in the west and the east simultaneously. Alistair stood a yard from Mary, and they looked from one sunset to the other.
"What is that in the east?"
"I don't know," said Alistair. "Some new kind of searchlight."
"So red."
"Could it be lithium? I didn't know we had anything that bright."
"I wish we could see over those buildings."
"Come on," said Alistair. "We should go back."
Mary craned her neck.
"But we haven't seen anything. Let's at least go as far as the river."
"The wardens won't like it."
"So? They can give us a good telling off. You won't cry, will you?"
He grinned.
"All right. Just as far as the river, and then we'll go back."
They reached the Thames and ducked under a barrier to get onto the half-built Waterloo Bridge. The pontoons were connected with a scaffold that sufficed if one didn't look down. Near the centre of the span, while the sun set over the water behind them, they had a clear view of the east. They stopped.
where the bombing was concentrated, flames rose hundreds of feet into the air. From time to time, high above, the pale underside of an aircraft would glow for a moment as it twisted through the light. The whole scene was inverted in the river, bent and shattered in the oily wavelets. As they watched the fires reaching down into the black depths, they felt the breeze on their backs as the distant flames drew air in. They stood with their hands gripping the scaffold, an arm's length apart. They listened to the roaring of the distant fires.
"Good God," said Alistair at last.
Mary said nothing, only stared at the conflagration.
"Mary, are you all right?"
He moved a foot closer and then stopped, dropping the hand he had been about to put on her arm. She looked up at him, took half a step forward, then hesitated. "We shouldn't go any further." He smiled.
"No, this mightn't take two people's weight."
She gave him a grateful look. "We ought to go back. To be safe."
"Yes, we really should."
They stood at the centre of the almost bridge, and she said, "I'm glad we went as far as we could." They walked back. The lacerated sky faded in the west and brightened in the east. When they reached the Lyceum, they stopped at stage door. Mary said, "You aren't coming in, are you?"
"I should find my regiment. The men get in a state without orders."
She looked away.
"You must do the right thing, of course."
"Would you say something to Hilda, from me, and to Tom?"
"If you like. I'm sure they'll understand."
"You're a rock."
She looked up at him sharply.
"Alistair, are we cowards?"
Their faces flashed in the frank light of the guns, and he was silent. Back down in the basement, someone had lit more candles. Tom rose when Mary returned. "Are you all right? What happened?"
"He had to go to his regiment. He said to let you know how sorry he is."
Hilda slumped.
"But what took so long? He couldn't leave until there was a gap in the bombing."
"He's mad," said Tom.
"It isn't as close as it seems down here. They're bombing the docks."
"Perhaps we should all go up," said Hilda. "One would hate to miss out on the action." Mary said nothing. "I was worried sick," said Tom. "I'm sorry. I know it's silly." Mary sat down with him.
"I was only upstairs."
"I should have come up. I know. I was just..." Mary took his hand to show that it didn't matter. Now that she was back in the basement, she began to shake. They waited down in the dark. After an hour, Mary said,
"I don't suppose there's any chance of a song."
Zachary's father cupped his hands.
"Any of my boys awake over there?"
Some answering calls came.
"Well, what about a tune?"
he asked them. There was nothing for a moment, while the sound of explosions rumbled on. Then a lone, low voice came.
"The Lord, he thought he'd make a man. These bones gonna rise again."
More voices joined.
"Made him from mud and grains of sand. These bones gonna rise again."
Zachary's father joined in, with his eyes closed, and now Zachary too.
"The Lord, he spoke with monstrous voice. These bones gonna rise again. Shook the world down to its joists. These bones gonna rise again."
The voices rang in the basement. On the bench beside Alistair's empty place, Hilda glowered at Mary. The city shook. Mary held Tom close and ran her fingers through his hair.
"It will be all right," she said. "You and I, we will be fine."
"Yes," he said.
"And tomorrow we'll all fix the mess, and on Monday everyone will go to work as usual."
"I suppose so," he said.
"What's the first thing you'll do on Monday morning?"
"I don't know," said Tom. "Inspect all the schools, check for damage." She squeezed his hand.
"Good."
"Then I suppose I will organise repairs as necessary, and check again that the open schools have adequate provision of shelters."
"That's good, darling."
"Eve took the needle, Adam took the plough. These bones gonna rise again. That's how we're all working now. These bones gonna rise again.
And what will you do on Monday morning? Said Tom. I shall stand in front of my class and tell them none of this palaver is an excuse for not having done one's homework.
You could tell that to Zachary now. He might use this time. She lowered her voice.
I go easier on him than the others. I think he might have something wrong with him, you know.
Besides being the wrong colour, you mean? She stared until she was sure he was only teasing her, and when he grinned, she jabbed him in the ribs.
You dog!
So what do you suppose is wrong with him? You'll scoff, but I've researched it, and I think he has word blindness.
Tom groaned.
No such thing.
But really, I've read papers on it.
By crackpots, I'm afraid.
Oh, I know you mean well, but just think about it. How can one be blind to something that is right there on the page?
She sighed.
I don't know, darling.
Right there in front of one, he said, picking up her hands and opening her palms like a book.
No further away than this. They say the eye sees, but there's a blind place in the mind.
And I say it is lack of effort. You must hold him to the same standard as everyone else. Because where should it stop, this fashionable clemency, once we allow that there are things we can see and yet be blind to? The singing voices swelled in the cellar, and the bombs gave the percussion, and the great injured city went further into night.
Oh, I don't know, darling. I don't know where it will stop.
Alistair woke in the grey hours. The all-clear was sounding a huge C sharp across the city. His body found coffee on its own. London created itself in concentric ripples widening from the cup. Around him were some men of his regiment. Most were in uniform. All were filthy and drawn. A brownish little cafe. A defeated sort of smell of wet charcoal and bonfire smoke. No biscuits or buns available. Everyone's eyes downcast, faces blackened with soot. His watch was in his pocket, inexplicably. 7 in the morning. He put it back on his wrist. His wallet was gone. He thought, they've stolen my leave. He had found his men and stood them drinks in the bars behind Waterloo. Then bombs had fallen near the station, and he had organised the men into teams to help the rescue crews. They had used their hands on the piles of brick and timber, digging out civilians and parts of civilians. There had been some competition to see which teams could clear houses the quickest. There had been a grown hand holding an infant hand, with neither attached to anything. There had been an accordion with the Bakelite case blistered and charred. It had helped to be drunk. Now he made his way to Waterloo Station, where the station master gave him more coffee and let him scrub in the staff washroom. Alistair stripped to the waist and ran a slow trickle of brown water into the basin. The main pipes were cracked, or the fire pumps were taking all the pressure. He cleaned up as well as he could, combed his hair with his fingers, and accepted a clean shirt that the station master offered. He needed the man's help to do up the buttons. His fingers were blistered and cut. He closed his mind to all thoughts of the previous night. This was what he had learned in France, that one could continue to operate quite adequately, so long as one stayed in the hour. At 8:30, his men began to arrive back at the station, singly and in lurching groups. Alistair slapped each man on the back and got him roughly corralled at one end of the concourse. It was a relief to be back in charge of something simpler than himself. Though his head was hammering with a hangover, it amused him to discover that the men were worse off. After the rescue work was done, it seemed that the majority had simply returned to the public houses, where normal service had continued in the cellars below the bars. It was impressive to see what the regiment had done to itself in 24 hours, with only indirect help from the enemy. "Big night," he said to a man who was bleeding from a cut above the eye.
"Yes, but we'll give it back to them double, won't we, sir?"
"The Germans?"
"Well, it nearly was fortunate, sir, that the Germans interrupted."
Alistair docked him 2 shillings of pay for fighting, wrote him a personal IOU for 2 shillings, and carried on. A private was complaining.
"If the Luftwaffe had let me have 1 more hour, I'd have got her in the sack."
"Look on the bright side," said Alistair. "If you'd had 1 more minute after that, you'd have got her in the family way." The man turned and saw him.
"Sorry, sir. Didn't know it was you."
"I hardly know myself. never mix wine and whisky. That's an order.
Not unless you're buying again, sir.
Alistair moved from man to man, keeping it light. Under the chatter, the men shook with anger. When it was time to face the Germans again, the grudge would be particular. His fellow officers were returning, looking rather better off than he, and they all set to work to reform the pacified and compliant men into the sterner geometries of war. On the station concourse, the men lined up quite docilely in their ranks, while the officers puffed on pipes and took the roll call and made sardonic inquiries concerning the men who were still AWOL. At 9, with the half-past raising steam at the platform and the men lining up to board, Alistair felt the universe returning to a bearable configuration. He looked up from the company list and saw Mary arriving on the concourse in the dress she had worn the day before, conspicuous amid the uniforms. She carried his duffel bag, which he had left at the Lyceum. His body's first instinct was to take cover. She hadn't seen him yet. He could easily just board the train, and he knew he ought to. Instead, he waited and smoked his pipe. He could not stop watching her. He was a little sick at himself for it, but he was too tired now to be a saint. As the men headed for the platform and their ranks thinned, Mary spotted him, broke into a smile, and waved. He caught himself waving back, his chest tightening, immediately guilty now that the choice could not be unmade. She hurried over, and then her face fell, and she stopped a yard short. She said,
"I was worried something might have happened to you."
"It did. I popped into town and collected this hangover."
"It suits you."
"It's a little tight around the temples."
"The others are all right, I hope?" "I told them I was going home to check up on Mother and Father."
"Well, now you can."
She looked down.
"You wish I hadn't come, don't you?"
He tapped out his pipe.
"It might have been better."
She looked up with a spark of anger.
"I am in love with Tom, you know."
"That's good."
"He is the gentlest man."
"Well, you know, I like him myself."
"I'm sure we shall be married."
"And I'm sure I'll be delighted for you. Let me know if you need a bridesmaid."
They stood, without speaking, while the last of the soldiers lugged bags towards the train and steam began to hiss from the locomotive. Mary set down his duffel bag on the platform between them.
"Thanks," said Alistair.
Hilda was furious.
"That's what you came to tell me?"
She closed her eyes.
"I came to make sure you were all right."
"Well, now you can tell Hilda I'm all right."
"Must you be so..."
"I'm sorry," said Alistair.
"No, I am. I'm just very tired."
"We'll both feel better after a night's sleep."
She managed a smile.
"Yes, I'm sure we shall."
The locomotive's boiler hissed louder. Alistair watched the last of the men boarding. He nodded to the officers who stood on the platform, watching this presumed lover's parting with theatrical amusement. He turned back to Mary.
"Look, yesterday was..."
"Wasn't it? Maybe I was wrong to bring Hilda. I hope you didn't feel too set up."
"It was sweet of you and Tom to do the upsetting."
"I just didn't think you'd be so..."
Alistair waved it away.
"Hilda is lovely. I'm sure if there'd been more than 24 hours..."
"If there'd been more time or less, it would all have been easier. If it's an hour, one can say what one likes. If it's a year, one can be what one is like. A day is exactly the wrong length of time to be oneself in, don't you think?"
She looked at him desperately. He took a step towards her, but the locomotive blew its whistle. She said,
"You should go."
He held her eyes.
"Goodbye."
"Yes, goodbye."
He picked up his duffel bag and turned to go. Mary said,
"I hope you'll be all right."
Alistair turned back.
"You'll be very happy. Tom is the best man I know."
She hesitated.
"Tom always told me you were funny. I hadn't for a minute imagined you would be so terribly sad."
Alistair set down his bag, put his hands in his pockets, and stared at his shoes for a moment.
"I'm hopeful," he said. "Aren't you?"
"Hopeful that what?"
"That this war does as much good as harm."
"You sound like the government posters."
He smiled.
"After the war, there'll be less distance between us all."
Is that your theory?
I can prove it. Last night, the men and I were in the back streets to see if we could make ourselves useful. There was an old man we helped, in the wreck of his house in a bathtub he'd been sheltering in. It was half full of water from the hoses, and when we got to the man, he scrubbed his back with a loofah to make us laugh. The whole street torn to shreds, and all of us in stitches. Don't you see? It makes me think there's hope.
Promise me you'll hold on to that.
Oh, good Lord, yes. Rather that than the loofah. She laughed then, brightly and without complication, and he laughed too, and for a moment the war with its lachrymose smoke was blown away on a bright, clean wind. Alistair marvelled that she could do such a thing with the tiniest inflection of her mouth and the lightest look in her eye. Even exhausted, in yesterday's dress, with her hair dishevelled, she could make the distance between them disappear. The whistle screamed again, and an officer yelled from the platform for Alistair to board.
"Well, goodbye," said Mary. "Don't let the Germans take all the best seats."
"Goodbye, Mary. Good luck." He shouldered his duffel bag and walked away down the platform. This was the end of it, he knew. They could give each other nothing more. There was a perfect sadness to it, but as the train took him back to the war and its hard hours issued singly, it wouldn't do to think of her. He left Mary to the hour in which she stood, beneath the hot black smoke that rose a mile above the wounded city. Part 2. Attrition. September 1940. Hilda picked her up at noon, and they took a cab east to look at the damage. Hilda wore black. Melodramatic, Mary thought. With a handkerchief pressed to her face in case of smoke and dust, and knee-high lace-up boots, since one couldn't anticipate the conditions underfoot, it seemed to Mary that Hilda was dressed for something between a funeral and Passchendaele. Mary had opted for pumps and a light blue day dress. When they got to Bow, she saw that Hilda had been right. Every window was out. In the bright sun, glass lay everywhere, so that if one half closed one's eyes, the streets were bejeweled. Pavements were undulant, walls bowed, street lamps wilted by heat. The city's perpendiculars were defeated. It was as if the bombs had reserved a particular spite for right angles. The pipes were cracked, too, and marshy water pooled in every new depression. Children splashed. The pigeons spritzed their wings in it. Their road was blocked by rubble, and the driver pulled up. Hilda opened the door, and hot air rolled in, heavy with soot and sewage. Everything smoked or steamed, as if one had crossed into a tropic of disaster. From the gaping fronts of bombed-out houses, the dazed locals stared. Mary stepped out of the cab into a puddle that leached foul-smelling mud through her shoe and into her stocking.
"Don't you think we should go straight back?" she said.
"Don't be wet," said Hilda. "These poor people have been through hell."
"But I feel such a ghoul for gawping. We're observing, and I'm damned if we'll be the only ones who haven't. It's all anyone will be talking about."
Mary gave in. They linked arms, going around gas flares that rose from cracked mains. They gave a wide berth to sewage bubbling up.
"You see?" said Hilda. "This is why I prefer the West End. This isn't funny at all."
Hilda looked as if she might cry.
"Did you kiss him?" "I'm sorry. Did you and Alistair kiss?"
Mary hesitated.
"Shall we talk about it at home? There's no privacy there. If Palmer isn't hovering, then your mother is materialising over one shoulder. It isn't a home, it's a haunting. At your flat, then? But it's never the right moment with you. You think you can do what you like, and we never mention it. But what about Tom? What about me?" "I didn't kiss Alistair, if you must know."
"I don't believe you for a moment." Mary shrugged.
"Fine."
Hilda's hands shook.
"You can tell me. I won't say anything to Tom." "Gosh, well, that's big of you."
"Please don't be cross," said Hilda, chewing her lip.
"I saw how you looked at Alistair."
Mary softened.
"Well, one does look, doesn't one? The eye may be an obligate scout, but the heart is not an incurable follower. Anyway, I saw how you looked at Alistair too. But I was there to look, and you weren't. We feign dispassion, don't we? It's called manners. Had it your way. But I didn't kiss him. Then what were you doing all that time? We were talking. You should try it. It's hardly my fault if you pack your wits into a hat box whenever a gentleman calls. But you've no right always to poach the man I like, just since you can. I didn't poach. I took him his bag. I told you to do it, but you wouldn't. But I was furious with him, don't you see? For going off without saying goodbye. I could hardly show it by running after him with his luggage. Well, you must tell me how fury is turning out for you. Hilda scowled at the ground. You'd be the same, if it happened to you. You should have followed him out of the basement. You didn't have to send me, but I was scared. And you suppose I wasn't? Hilda only raised her hands and let them fall to her sides. Mary closed her eyes for a moment. I promise I didn't do anything with Alistair. I'm in love with Tom, and I try extremely hard to show it.
Hilda gave her a bitter look.
And did trying work last night? Yes. All that happened was that Alistair went away on a train, with his bag, to who knows where he's to be deployed. So if you've anything to say to him, I suggest you jolly well write. I shan't think of him again. I have a man I love, and a class to teach, and for me the matter is closed.
And yet you are always incorrigibly you.
All I can tell you is how you seem to me now. This rubble was people's homes only yesterday, and here's you, standing on it and bleating. Sometimes, Hilda, though I try not to, I think you impossibly spoiled.
The colour bled from Hilda's face.
Oh, no, said Mary, reaching out. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that.
Hilda pushed her arm away.
I'm glad you did. Because although I've tried for years not to, I think you impossibly selfish. I know you kissed Alistair. I'm exhausted from always forgiving you, and I simply won't do so any more.
Please, said Mary.
No, goodbye. I'll go home on my own.
Glass cracked under her boots as she went. Mary slumped against the steaming wall and looked up at the sky. The blue was stained by updrafts of smoke as the air drifted towards the fires in the docks. How sad one could feel. She wondered how it had happened that Tom was so distant and Hilda so bitter, and the world so thoroughly shattered. She supposed she ought to go home. At least as one went west, the streets would become clean and undamaged. One could always imagine that one's life, though smouldering in parts, might be undamaged in the west. She took the long way home along the embankment. The Thames was black with oil. Sickly foam gushed up wherever the deep current of the river was forced to the surface by obstructions, crashed bombers, buses blown off bridges. Who knew what was down there now? The old and changeless river was suddenly uncharted. She stared down into the black water, scorched in patches by little pools of burning oil that whirled and eddied in the current. Flaming barges, their mooring ropes burned through, were drifting upstream on the flood tide. She wondered how far upriver the barges would get. If they kept on burning, then it would be a furious light they cast on Pimlico, where Palmer, even now, must be readying tea to serve at 4.
December 1940. Snow was falling outside the window of Tom's office at the Education Authority. A secretary brought him a manila envelope containing a letter from the Royal Air Force. He gave a silent prayer of thanks. He had volunteered after that terrible night in the basement of the Lyceum and held his breath ever since. Now he stubbed out his cigarette in the blue glass ashtray on his desk, took a deep breath, and tore the letter open. These were the facts. He had achieved an excellent pass on 100 verbal and spatial exercises to be completed in 90 minutes. He had seen the numbers 9 and 4 in a field of dots that would have seemed numberless to men who could not perceive colour. He had surrendered into glass vials 1 fluid ounce of urine and 1 of venous blood, and both had been assayed and found to be as suitable as such fluids could be. Under the supervision of a mustachioed man from Bristol, he had stripped to his smalls and completed 15 press-ups and 8 pull-ups, then climbed a rope 18 feet in height and 2 inches in diameter.
Using the checkboxes provided, he had affirmed that he was neither an atheist nor a conscientious objector, and that his allergies were nil. A nurse had cupped his scrotum while he coughed, though the letter did not mention this. It went on to confirm that he had performed well at interview. The recruiting officer had liked Tom's use of the RAF's published battle losses. 20 men per day were being killed. Tom had framed it as one good man each hour. When viewed in that way, he had told the interviewer, one understood a life's value concretely. One saw the hours as a chain joining peacetime to peacetime, with oneself as a willing link. The recruiting officer had found his answer very satisfactory. Tom couldn't wait to show Mary the letter. There had been such a distance between them since the raids began. Nothing was said, but he missed the way they used to walk, as they had after their first night together, through a world made anew. He missed the way they had made rain hilarious, and passers-by mysterious, and bridges cross more than the river. Of course there was the bombing, which kept them apart every night, she and the Anderson at her parents' home, and he in the public shelter on Prince of Wales Road. But even alone together at the weekend in the garret, there was a certain hesitation. Their lovemaking felt like politeness. But now here was the letter, to remake him in Mary's eyes and his own. Life had finally arrived and been released from its manila envelope. In the final paragraph, the recruiting officer regretted to inform him that his application had been vetoed by the War Office, who considered his current role essential. He read the thing through again, and there was no ambiguity. It was a feature of the authorities that they could exempt one's profession from service without sparing one's feelings. Tom sat in his empty office, laid his head on the desk, and closed his eyes. When he could no longer stand it, he crossed the road to the public house and drank 3 doubles in a row. He went out into the snow, walked for a while without purpose, and then headed for Mary's school. When he got there, he knocked the snow from his shoes and coat, sat on a tiny chair at the back of her classroom, and watched her taking the children through the dress rehearsal for their nativity play. A saviour was born for all mankind, this seemed to be the gist of it. Everyone would be excused for everything they'd done. It sounded neat. His hands still shook from the cold, so he clasped them to his knees. Mary mouthed to him, "Are you all right?" He smiled back at her across the children's heads, while every one of his nerves vibrated with the high note of a cable approaching its maximum tension. The little ones were in costume. Mary sat at the piano, producing a rather chirpy version of "It Came Upon the Midnight Clear." She even managed to swing the tune a little, giving the distinct impression that whatever had come on that clear midnight had come via the drinks cabinet. He ached for her. There was nothing she couldn't transform. It was unbearable. She had cast a nice, sensible girl as the narrator. Betty came forward as the last chord faded.
"Long ago, in the city of Nazareth, an angel came to Joseph and Mary, and the angel said..."
There was a long silence, during which everyone looked at the angel. From the piano, Mary whispered,
"Behold!"
Kenneth remembered his line,
"Behold, a virgin shall be with child, and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel."
"Speak up," said Mary. "There are a few Chinese who mightn't have heard you."
"Emmanuel,"
whispered Kenneth. His wings, which were of papier-mâché, slipped down to his waist. Poppy, who was dressed as a lamb, went behind him to hold the wings up to his shoulders. Together they made a hybrid creature that had not been needed in any of the myths. Tom laughed, but tears prickled at the same time. He supposed he was only exhausted. The bombing kept everyone awake. At the office, one had become accustomed to colleagues making a sudden break for the lavatory. Everyone knew it was only to weep, and yet it would seem to outsiders as if the city were in the grip not of war, but of some great bellicose incontinence. He tried to concentrate on the play. Thomas, dressed in a toga and with a laurel crown on his head, propelled himself to centre stage in his wheelchair, which had been clad with gold boards to make it into a Roman chariot. Betty said,
"And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus.
Thomas said,
All the world shall be taxed.
Maud came to the front with Zachary, both in robes and tea towels, with halos wobbling. Maud was a timid girl, rather a good casting for the Virgin Mother. Tom felt that Zachary was an inspired choice for Joseph, and he wondered if Mary had meant it as a joke. It would be easy to verify the divine provenance, the deity being white and the husband as dark as Herod's heart. Now he worried that he didn't know whether she had meant it to be funny. He knew her less than he had at the start. The enemy dropped payloads of doubt. He wished he had Alistair for advice.
Alistair, old man, he might say. I'm beside myself. I'm spent.
But Alistair was in Malta now, and his letters came infrequently. When they did, they had no substance. Everything operational was omitted, anything sentimental avoided, until only their old jokes remained. Perhaps the friendship was over. Perhaps it was not possible, after all, for a man who had gone to war to abide a man who had stayed. He gripped his tiny chair and ground his teeth in misery. Betty said,
But in Bethlehem there was no room for them anywhere.
The children lined up to sing. They stood in order of diminishing glory, angels to lambs. Beside Poppy, there were two more lambs in white jumpers with cotton-wool twists. There was little Beryl, the beauty with her fixed smile and disconcerting stillness, and there was the idiot George, whose size was alarming amid the diminutive cast, but who followed Poppy with great docility. The lambs lined up beside Caesar, the holy spouses, the angel, and the narrator. As Mary struck up the tune on the piano, they sang.
No beautiful chamber, no soft cradle bed, no place for a manger, nowhere for his head. No praises of gladness, no thought of their sin. No glory but sadness, no room in the inn.
Tom lurched from anguish to a desperate urge to laugh again. How perfect that a saviour had come to earth who could heal and forgive, but that what everyone sang about was the local guest house being full. It was a perfectly English take on a divine visitation, the kind of thing old colonels wrote indignant letters to the Daily Telegraph about.
Sir!
But there was a comfort, after all, in the old, unchanging story. Perhaps the distance would close again between him and Mary. Perhaps it wasn't just him. Maybe everyone felt unsure, from the crushing fatigue and the fear, the constant mental strain of saying to others, "We shall prevail," and to oneself, "I am defeated." Now, hearing the children sing, Tom felt a glow of hope. Perhaps the war would be won after all. Mary would laugh in his arms again, and the great moaning sirens would stop. When the children came to the end of the song, Mary kept the music going softly while the holy couple laid a doll in a straw-lined milk crate. Betty said,
And she brought forth her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger. And the shepherds came from the fields, and asked Joseph the newborn's name. And Joseph said...
A long pause.
And Joseph said...
Zachary was frozen, eyes wide.
Come on, darling,
prompted Mary.
Joseph said...
Zachary burst into tears and bolted, slamming the classroom door behind him. The children began to laugh and murmur until Mary silenced them with two claps of her hands.
Children, please... We'll practice the hymn again. Mr. Shaw, would you please go and see to Zachary?
Tom found himself making the foolish gesture of, Who, me? And almost died under Mary's patient look. He found the boy in front of the school, kicking furiously at the snow.
It's stupid,
Zachary shouted when he saw Tom.
It's a stupid play, and I don't even want to remember my stupid lines.
Tom almost argued, then gave up, and leaned against the porch. Zachary scowled at him.
You don't care?
It isn't Hamlet.
You're drunk.
Tom lit a cigarette. Tell me,
Why do you come to school?
Get my education.
And what will you do with it?
Get a job. I'm not going in the minstrel show.
Why not?
You saw it. Would you be in it?
I can't imagine the equivalent. There's no such thing as a white minstrel show, is there? Unless one does count Hamlet.
I don't care about that.
You don't care about much.
You don't know.
But you keep running away. Miss North showed me your reports.
So?
So, I'm just saying, if you want to come to school, why do you run off? Zachary looked down.
Are you going to give me detention?
Tom couldn't help laughing.
What?
Said Zachary. Detention? No, not unless you kick any more of that snow my way. Zachary stopped.
It's too much, if you want to know.
What's too much?
Writing, maths, all of them staring at me in class. My head goes, I can't do this, I can't be here, louder and louder till I run. I want to stay, but I can't.
Tom turned up his collar against the cold.
Well?
Said Zachary. Well, what? I've no idea what's wrong with you. Zachary hesitated.
But you think there's something?
Miss North thinks you have word blindness. She hasn't reached a diagnosis for me.
Why? What is it with you?
Tom shrugged. With a name, it might be excusable. The wind got up, whipping snow at their faces. How long do you want to stay out here? Said Tom. Zachary dug his hands in his pockets and said nothing. It's harder to go back, isn't it? Said Tom.
Why don't you let me drag you?
Zachary showed no expression.
Go in, if you're called. I'll follow if I like.
Tom weighed it for a moment, then said, Fine, and went in. Halfway down the corridor, in case the boy was following, he said over his shoulder, The newborn's name is Jesus, by the way, in case the shepherds ask again. A pause, a scuffing of shoes behind him. Then,
I'm not retarded.
Tom grinned. In the classroom, Betty Oates was saying,
An angel told the shepherds to come from the fields and look, and the shepherds came, and they were amazed.
George and Poppy had been giggling together, and now their laughter became hysterical. Mary frowned over the top of the piano.
When your parents are here tomorrow for the real thing, neither I nor the angels shall expect to hear any silliness. Is that understood? Now carry on, please.
The children sang Silent Night. They changed back into their uniforms and tidied the manger. They hung halos up on pegs and went home early to be well ahead of the evening's raid when it came. Mary sat down with Tom in the back of the empty classroom.
You did well to bring Zachary back?
Oh, I didn't do anything. You were right about the boy. He's okay. She stroked his cheek.
You're okay.
Ah, but you're something else.
That's what my father says. Although I'm not sure he means it as kindly as you do. Walk me home?
I'm not sure.
Oh, you mustn't mind my father. He's almost never at home. And if he is, then he'll make you drink a glass of his Christmas wine, that's all. Palmer makes it from clothes and church bells and Dickens. Practice your face for me.
Tom licked his lips. That is superb. Mary looked worried.
Too much.
Tom tried again.
What an interesting flavour.
She nodded approval.
You oughtn't to overdo it, or Father will make you drink a second glass. It has happened before.
Did the victim survive?
The dog found the vat one year. We buried him under the japonica.
They went outside. The snow fell in graceless clumps. It turned to a greasy slush on the pavement, and soon they were both cold and wet.
Isn't it good? Mary said. If this holds up, there won't be a raid tonight.
Tom eyed the sky. I really hate them, you know. I never thought I had it in me. But they really are the most hateful bastards.
That's why we call them the enemy. See how it works now, darling?
He smiled. I don't know what I should do without you.
You'd live your life in terrible confusion,
she said gaily, taking his arm. He slowed to a stop under the scant shelter of a grocer's awning.
The shop window was cross-hatched with tape, and behind it the bacon slicer and the cheese wire and the black iron scales stood on the empty shelves, the vocabulary of a language with no remaining speakers.
Tom, darling?
He realized he was still staring into the hungry shop. I think you should leave me, he said. The wind whipped wet snow at their legs. Engines raced as motor cars' tires spun in the slush. Mary said, "Shall we go somewhere warm?" They found a cafe, two tables wide, with empty sugar shakers and a bare Jacob's biscuit display case on the counter. They were the only customers. They took off their gloves, but kept their coats and hats on.
"I don't suppose you've anything to eat," said Mary to the waitress.
"There's only tea."
It came in a brown glazed teapot. Looking into it as it was stirred, one could cultivate the hope that the tea was strong. One hoped, as one had hoped all through these gradually diluted months, until finally one poured it out over the quarter inch of thin white milk and saw that it was practically clear. The leaves were used to exhaustion. Tom rattled a teaspoon round his cup.
"I tried to join the Air Force." She put her hand on his.
"No.
I thought I might have it in me to shoot at the Germans' bloody aeroplanes, now that it's self-defense. But the War Office won't let me."
"Oh, Tom.
I thought you might be proud of me in uniform."
She took his face and angled it up to look at her.
"Do you really think so little of me?"
"You're a sweet, loyal girl. But we both know it isn't how it was."
"Of course it isn't, you silly man. We're 1,000 years older.
I sometimes imagine what it would be like for you if you were with a man like Alistair. Someone fighting the real war."
They stirred the pale tea. The wet snow blinded the window.
"I don't imagine it,"
she said.
"But you thought about it."
He waited. Her teaspoon clinked against the cup.
"I don't suppose I was meant to love a man like that. His heart made so heavy by war."
"But he has had to become like that."
"Well, we don't have to."
"Don't we, though? I feel worse every day I stay behind. One knows one won't be killed, but that's hardly the same as living."
"Please."
He held his head in his hands.
"I'm no use, you see."
"Don't,"
said Mary.
"We'll get you back on your feet. A glass of my father's Christmas wine will do the trick. It's so ghastly, I promise it will make you forget these blues and pray for simple death."
It made it all the more awful that she was so indestructible.
"Please," he said. "You'd be so much happier without me."
"But it wouldn't be my life, don't you see? You are the one I've chosen, and I love you even more for being good enough to ask me not to choose you."
A ghost of a smile rose in him.
"You are quite mad, I think."
"Mother just calls me stubborn."
Tom felt utterly spent, as weak as the tea. It was terrifying how close one came to cracking up.
"God, I'm sorry."
She shook her head.
"We must take turns, don't you think? Every time one of us is buried like this, we shall dig the other out."
They sat for a few minutes in the empty cafe, finishing the tea while there was still warmth in it. Another couple came in and stamped the slush off their shoes, she in a long hooded cape and he in the uniform of a naval officer. The waitress served them biscuits from under the counter. Mary laughed and took Tom's hand.
"Come on, let's get out of here."
Out in the snow, they drew their coats tight to the throat and walked hand in hand. Although the winter storm was bitter, there was comfort in it, since it meant there would be no raid that night. Later they would sleep together, this was understood, and if there was less heat in it than there had been at the start, then perhaps there might be more warmth. As the dark afternoon sank into night, they made their way in silence through the blind city. Their footsteps were softened by the snow. The incalculable damage was hidden, the mounds of rubble turned by the drifts into the shapes of clouds or waves, forms that might naturally be expected to blow through when kinder weather came. As the light and the sound faded to nothing, all that was left was the two of them. Underneath everything lay the colossal buried city, the patched-up pipes and the improvised lines of communication and the subterranean refuges from the great disincorporating influence of bombs. With the snow, it was possible to forget it. Perhaps, thought Mary, they really would rescue each other in turn. Perhaps the city would stand. For now, though, she could only hold Tom's hand. The snow settled. One settled. The searchlight beams rose from their rooftop installations, up through the swirling snow, and played in blue-white circles on the base of the clouds. One could follow the elegant line of a beam up into the whiteness of the storm that spanned all of Europe in its vortex. One could take in the vast sweep of the winter and follow a thin searchlight beam down again into the vigilant city and understand how very fragile it was. A woman and a man holding hands, on streets made nameless by snow.
"I love you," she said.
"Do you?"
"Oh, let's not go to my parents. It isn't far to your place."
There was an urgency now in the heat of their hands as they clung to each other. This snow would thaw. These winds would blow the clouds away. The next night might see a bomber's sky. December 1940. Alistair sailed the boat while Simonson, one of two other captains attached to 200 Battery, 10 Heavy Anti-Aircraft Regiment Royal Artillery, fished for tunny with a trawling line. In a 14-foot sailing dinghy, half a mile off the east coast of Malta, with a breeze blowing in off the immaculate Mediterranean, and with two bottles of the local beer in a string bag trailing in their wake to cool, the war seemed improbable and excessive.
"No, I'm afraid you will have to run it past me again," said Alistair, nudging the tiller with his toe. "There's a man called..."
"Something Hitler," said Simonson. "Axel? Albrecht? German chap. And he wants to take over the running of the world."
"What, all of it?"
"So it is rumoured."
Alistair frowned.
"With all its tedious responsibilities, along with the evident perks."
"One imagines the fellow has weighed it up and decided to press on regardless."
"Has he considered how vexatious it would be to find oneself in charge of us? Or how independent-minded the Americans are? I should think it would be frowned upon to turn up in Manhattan and start directing the traffic. As a European, I mean."
"My dear boy, these are questions we Brits have thrashed out over centuries. One cannot expect a Hun to have quite the same level of insight."
Alistair got his pipe alight while steering with one foot, trimming the jib with the hand he held the match in. He puffed white smoke that the wind scooped away prettily over the russet cloth of the mainsail. He said,
"This German fellow sounds like a card."
Simonson gave the trawling line an experimental tug.
"He has only one testicle, you know."
Alistair raised an eyebrow.
"Oh, yes,"
said Simonson.
"It is well known."
1,000 miles to the west lay Gibraltar, 1,000 miles to the east, Alexandria. Though it was nearly Christmas and the water too chilly for swimming, it was pleasant in the sun and the two men were comfortable in white shirts and civilian slacks. Simonson pulled in the trawling line to check that the spinner wasn't tangled.
2 hours and not a single bite. Fish are Nazis.
Maybe you're using the wrong lure?
Simonson shook his head.
The fish are mocking me. They know I'm famished, and they're swimming 6 inches behind the spinner in their silvery lederhosen.
They are goose swimming, said Alistair,
using a hand to approximate the motion.
But of course, said Simonson. They are the master place.
While they both looked back at their wake, a floating mine bobbed in it. Just the topmost part, black and lethal with protuberances, broke surface in the troughs of the waves. They could only have missed it by inches.
Ah, said Alistair, the upwind mark. I must ask the Commodore to paint them a little brighter.
They tacked the boat and had another look as they went back past.
Would it have gone off if we'd hit it, do you suppose, with our wooden hull? Or do they only trigger by magnetism?
How curious are you to find out?
Absolutely not at all.
Let's try to miss it all over again then, shall we? Said Alistair. I suppose we ought to be getting home, in any case.
Oh, God, is it wartime already?
Look on the bright side. It'll be dinner when we get back.
Simonson groaned. Dinner that night would be with the regiment in Valletta, in Fort St. Elmo, at the mouth of the Grand Harbour. Having shaved and dressed, they would go down into the bowels of the fortress that had survived Malta's great siege in the 16th century. In the officers' mess room, they would sit at folding aluminium tables to eat the pitiful rations of the present blockade.